This is Dick Weiss of Weiss Wright LLC, and we're with Jack Hart at the NEMA Narrative Conference. Jack is a managing editor and writing coach at the Oregonian in Portland. And Jack has a new book out. It's called A Writer's Coach, An Editor's Guide to Words That Work. And it's a terrific book. Jack, how did you decide to write this book, and why did you call it A Writer's Coach?
I call it A Writer's Coach because the title that I preferred was taken by another book. My editor insisted on it. In the end, I think that that she turned out to be correct on that count. I was originally going to call it Wordcraft. It turns out that there's a book by the same publisher called Wordcraft that came out a couple of years ago that is about branding and that uses examples of choosing successful words to sell products. And one of their examples, of course, is Viagra. So we decided we probably ought to look at it.
And this book is selling as well as Viagra?
Well, I don't know. That one's aimed at marketers and that type. It's probably not selling as well as the books produced by the Jack Hart who writes gay pornography. Who you'll Google things on that.
What's his website?
I'm sure he has one.
Tell me a little bit about your growth as a writer. One of the questions I like to ask writers is if they could take, you're a storyteller, take me back to the moment when you knew you were going to be a writer. And when was that?
I was at the University of Washington. I was a pre-med major, and there was a wonderful professor there, former editor of the Cleveland Press, guy with an Ivy League PhD, who was a journalistic historian named Henry Ladd Smith. And just to fulfill a distribution requirement, I took a basic, you know, kind of a journalism 101 writing class from him. And he used to bum cigarettes from me back in those days when all newsroom types smoked. And I was walking down the hall one day, and he said, "Hart, come on in here. Have a cup of tea." Got a cigarette, and he looked out his window, and he said, "What is that goddamn thing out there?" And there was this crane rising on the top of a high-rise dorm that was being built on campus. He said, "I've never seen anything like that. Go find out what that is and write me a story for class." And it turned out to be the first German self-erecting crane, one of these things you see everywhere now that climb up, lift themselves up as a building is under construction. So I wrote a piece for him and turned it in, and lo and behold, next morning I picked up a copy of the University of Washington Daily, and there was my story with my byline. He turned it into the Daily, and they had a picture. And I thought that was so great that from that day forward I started to think of myself as a writer and a journalist, and instead of probably a bad doctor. And I'm a bad journalist instead of a bad doctor.
And you didn't go right into newspapers, did you?
Well, no. There was a war on, and I had a full-ride fellowship at the University of Wisconsin.
That was World War One.
Well, yeah, it was, actually. The Battle of the Somme had just been fought. And it didn't look like the war was going to be over real soon, so I went to grad school. No, that was Vietnam, and I was a commissioned Army officer, and I could take an educational delay to go to grad school on a full ride at the University of Wisconsin. So, full ride at a great party school like the University of Wisconsin, or a rice paddy in Vietnam, that was my choice. Mm-hmm. And so I went on to grad school, got a doctorate at Wisconsin, and then taught full-time in journalism schools for 12 years while I was working on and on as a journalist at various newspapers.
And how did you end up at the Oregonian?
Well, I was teaching at the University of Oregon, and I wanted to get back and get more professional experience. And so I took a one-year leave from the university with the full intention of coming back, and came up to the Oregonian just to do general assignment reporting. And one thing led to another. The paper, which wasn't very good in those days, kept getting better. I kept getting better jobs. I extended the leave and finally resigned my commission at the university to make a full-time commitment at the newspaper.
So you actually started the Oregonian as a reporter?
I was. I was a GA reporter back in the days when there were such things.
Tell me about one of your memorable stories as a GA reporter. Are there any that you refer your staff back to say, read this?
I remember a couple of real screw-ups. I remember covering a speech one time. Actually, I think that was at the Eugene Register Guard. and mistaking the Rotary Club for Kiwanis in the story.
Oh. That's kind of like the Sunni and the Shia, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, you have those kinds of lessons when you're young, and then you can be a hard-ass editor and insist.
Did you start off writing narrative?
No. I didn't even know what narrative meant in those days. I mean, I wrote features and takeouts and kind of wanted to get into in-depth multi-part stories of the sort that the paper really didn't do at that time. They didn't know what to do with the first two or three stories like that I handed in. So I did always try to have a back burner kind of project going of some kind. That involved some feature writing. And when I would cover, I covered a great Maritime Commission hearing one time, was a story I really enjoyed doing. A captain was on trial for some negligence that resulted in an explosion aboard ship, and a fellow was killed. And I wrote that in kind of narrative style, not really knowing that I was doing that. And it got a great reception from a lot of the old curmudgeons in the newsroom. They really liked it. And so I guess that taught me something.
And was there a point at which you more or less discovered narrative, or did you kind of just do it by instinct for a while and then realize there was this form?
Well, I was the editor of our Sunday magazine, and narrative has long been a staple of American magazine journalism. So I made a real effort as the editor of that magazine to run it like a magazine and to study how magazines operated. We tried to structure it like a real national magazine. We tried to do assignments like real national magazine. We did a lot of coaching because most of our freelance writers and newsroom writers really didn't know magazine writing. And so that pushed us in the direction of narrative writing and also gave me a chance to work with some national caliber freelance writers who knew narrative writing. And at the same time, Tom Hallman, who was then one of our police reporters, did a couple of stories for me at the magazine, and he was exploring the form. So we kept working together off and on over the years and pushing each other, I think, toward a better understanding of narrative. But one time, John Franklin taught at Oregon State University, and Hallman would go down there once a week to sit at the master's knee and learn narrative. So I started really reading and studying and working with people like Hallman then, and through a whole series of stories got more and more intrigued by the possibilities of that kind of storytelling for certainly in our magazine, but for the newspaper as a whole. And then I discovered that if you go back and read things like A Treasury of Great Reporting, that good journalists have been doing this from the get-go, from the very first years of print journalism. There's been good narrative writing parallel to the kind of report writing that came to utterly dominate in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, it's funny what's happened to this word narrative. It's become kind of a stylish word. Several years ago, a lot of people didn't even know what the word meant. And now, if you go into Nordstrom's, you'll see a department that's called narrative. You hear from politicians, and they say they need to give a narrative to the American people about where they're taking the country or about themselves.
Yeah. Trial lawyers talk about who has the best narrative.
So I guess that's a measure of how far we've come or how far we've regressed.
There's a great opening to one of the Seinfeld programs in which Kramer stumbles into Jerry's apartment and thrashes around, and Jerry finally, that's the stock opening. Jerry finally says, "What in the hell's bothering you, Kramer?" And he says, "Jerry, I just realized I have no narrative arc."
So one of the things I want to ask you about is, Tom Hallman, with the benefit of hindsight, we could say, God, that guy was a natural. He, he's been a Pulitzer Prize finalist a few times. He's won it, won a lot of awards. But as you pointed out, he was, just a police reporter like any other guy. Is there something in a reporter's makeup where you could say, that guy's going to be, or that woman's going to be a great narrative writer?
Guts. I mean, you have to have the guts to try something new and different, and sometimes go against the grain of the newsroom if you're a newspaper reporter, or broadcast reporter for that matter, because all the pressure is to do the same thing everybody else is doing. So I think the good narrative writers are those who, for one reason or another, were willing to set their own course and to try things and to fail on occasion. And Hallman was willing to do that. So he would be the first to tell you he's not a particularly stylish or polished writer. He doesn't have any great secrets. He's just willing to try things, and he follows Walt Harrington's advice, which is that you never should do the same thing twice. Tom is always trying something new, usually with every major outing that he takes on the narrative trail. So, you know, there's a mystique to writing, and not just narrative writing, but to writing as a whole, and that's one of the themes of this book that just came out, that builds it up in people's mind so that they think that the accomplished professionals just spin webs of gold when they sit down at the keyboard. And in point of fact, as Hemingway said, all first drafts are shit. And you build a story from the get-go, a good collaboration between an editor and writer, like the one that Tom and I have, I think is a great aid to both. But we talk things through all the way. They develop. They don't really amount to much in the early stages. And even if it's a big project and there are going to be multiple drafts, the first draft is not all that impressive usually. It's the continuing work and the craft and the method that goes into it that makes something good in the end.
When you he started with Tom, was it just right away a great symbiotic relationship, or was it difficult? And how do you get, let's just say that you have another reporter that you're bringing along or trying to coach, and there are issues. How do you get past those?
Tom and I think got along pretty well from the beginning. And you know that first story he did for me at Northwest Magazine 20 years ago stands up pretty well when I go back and look at it. It's obvious that both he and I have learned a lot since then. But we've had a good working relationship all along. And the fact that we were both interested in exploring the form and had common goals really helped. And we just have a good relationship, and I think sort of some complementary skills in a way. That's not always the case. I remember working the night shift once years ago, and a crusty old reporter who was a real traditionalist had been out on a story, and he came back, and I was asking him a bunch of questions about what he discovered out there in the field, and after answering about 10 questions, he looked at me kind of quizzically and said, "This is some of that coaching shit, isn't it?" So, and I had to smile and say, "Yeah, it is." He went to work and turned out a perfectly good story. And I mean, he was taking it with a grain of salt. The way the structure works in our newsroom, I think I gravitate toward writers, and writers gravitate toward me when we have common interests. And so
people who want that coaching shit.
Yeah, they tend to come to me, and often with their editors, so that it's a real team effort all around.
Yeah. Let's just say there's an editor who wants to sort of get in the game with narrative. What would be the first baby steps that he or she should take?
Well, there's one here at this conference, and one of our assistant business editors has expressed a real interest in that. He came to me, and he got a reading list. He worked with me and business writers on a couple of stories, and then I arranged for it to be possible for him to come to this conference. And so, you know, he has multiple goals for himself in his career, but that's one of them, and he's working at it in a very systematic, methodical way. So he will keep coming back to me for more reading as time goes on, and he and I will work together with writers on more sophisticated narrative stories as time goes on.
With beginning narrative writers, what do you find is the most common mistake that they make?
Journalistic report writers, and 90% of what we do consists of reports, not stories. We call everything a story, but most of them are reports in which the purpose is primarily informational, as opposed to a story, which is trying to put somebody there so they can experience something for themselves. So stories are more experiential. And most newspaper report writers kind of operate on the middle levels of the ladder of abstraction. They are summarizing a whole series of events and describing those in fairly abstract terms. in a typical newspaper report. So even the lead on an accident story describes something that unfolded over extended amount of time, probably. Certainly the lead on a fire story would. And the experts, the literary experts, call that summary narrative, which is an obvious way to describe it. You are summarizing a lot of things. You know, they drove toward the Capitol in three armored columns, and after 4 days they were within 20 miles. That's summary narrative. You have collapsed a whole lot of stuff into a really overarching, abstract description. And yet, much of narrative takes place in more real time, or at least it creates the illusion of real time. And you're inside a scene describing things that are happening so that the reader can imagine being there and witnessing it for himself or herself. And that's logically enough called dramatic narrative, or sometimes scenic narrative. And learning the difference between the two is very difficult for people who've been writing summary narrative only for a long, long time. They instinctively kind of know the difference, and once they get it, they really get it. I was working with a first-time narrative writer, a political writer, one time. He was writing about a freshman senator's experience in Washington, D.C., and we had been going back and forth, and I was trying to push him down the ladder of abstraction, get more specific description, get him writing stuff from the inside of scenes, and he finally said, "Ah," he said, "I get it. You're either in story or you're out of story." And that's exactly the difference between summary narrative and scenic or dramatic narrative.
You had a participated in a panel yesterday talking about how narrative writing can actually be healthy for the bottom line. Stockholders ought to be interested in this. What did you mean by that?
Well, I just think that in this day and age, when the media marketplace is fragmenting, when people have more options exponentially than ever before, different ways to get information, like podcasts, that we have to use every trick in our kit bag in newspapers. And that doesn't mean simply replacing the inverted pyramid news report with narrative stories. You wouldn't want to do that. I think there will always be a place for the inverted pyramid news report, but there are also lots of other ways of presenting information in report form that are alternatives to the inverted pyramid. And narrative is just one more thing that you can offer to a print reader, which is particularly well suited to print, I think, that can make the newspaper a continuing attraction for at least one portion of the audience.
You know, a lot of people talk about the online world as if in some ways it's for people with attention deficit, because you're constantly clicking, and reading summaries. And yet I kind of feel that there's a home for narrative online because of the ways in which you can present those stories. Have you done anything at the Oregonian in any way ambitious in terms of doing narrative online?
Most of our online multimedia stuff so far consists of report-type material. I would like us to get into more true storytelling online, although I think it has to be somewhat different than what you would be doing in print. But when you think about it, you know, Mark Bowden's Black Hawk Down was a terrific on newsprint newspaper series, but it was put online at the Inquirer, I think,
right,
wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And became, it got national attention because of the fact that they made a big production about it online. And once that happened, Bowden got a book contract, and then there was a hardcover book, and then there was a softcover book, and then Ridley Scott did the movie.
Right. And do you know that it was also a video game?
I'm not surprised. And that's interesting, because video games have a storyline. So I'm really interested to know that. We just had a session in our newsroom last week. Chris Chivers of the New York Times was on a patrol in Iraq, an infantry squad, when the squad was attacked by a sniper, and one of the squad members, the radio man, was seriously wounded. he did a story for the front page of the New York Times on that, and they made it into a real issue story, saying, trying to get the larger context, sniping is becoming a bigger problem, this has changed the whole tactical approach to infantry operations in Baghdad, and so on and so forth, the kind of stuff you'd expect from the New York Times. But online, he did a 5-minute narration of a series of terrific photographs by the photographer who was on that patrol, and it was tremendously powerful and moving, and it kind of changed my thinking about what kind of storytelling is possible online. And we showed that in our morning news meeting when all our editors were there, and then had a big discussion about the differences between the way the story was handled in print by the New York Times Page One crew and this 5-minute podcast, essentially, that was a fine bit of storytelling. On the other hand, our new media people said, 5 minutes? Oh, 5 minutes is an eternity online. That'll never work, you know? But obviously it did.
Yeah. The this may sound a little scary to a lot of writers who devote so much of their energy just to figuring out how to write a story. And with the advent of online, they may be wondering, well, now do I have to carry a camera? Do I have to carry a digital recorder? Do I need to have a digital video recorder? Is that going to be distracting or mess me up? Do you think a writer ought to be learning how to all those kinds of production skills and photographic
skills?
Maybe
it depends on your age. Maybe if you're as old as I am.
But for you, young man.
Well, I've been thinking about that a lot. You're not just a writer, for one thing. If you're writing narrative, you're already thinking in scenes, and you're thinking about scenic construction. So you're already halfway there, whether you're going to present an additional component with still photography or with video. And, well, I was just talking to Angela Pancrazio, who's here. I worked with her at the Oregonian. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer. She's at the Arizona Republic now. When she was at the Oregonian, she worked with me to work on her writing so she could be a double threat kind of staffer and do both the writing and photography on her own projects. And now she's studying very hard with a video camera and has studied all the software and editing software. And she loves it, and she's already done her first videos, which have been posted on the Republic website. So I think people with a particular inclination to do that kind of thing will find it challenging and creative and liberating. And when I talk to young people just coming out of college now, one thing I consistently hear is that they're trying to cover as many bases as possible. They're taking classes in video production, in photography, in audio production and editing, because they know that the job market is going to be constantly changing as all these different media mix it up out there in the marketplace.
If you had to recommend, other than your book, which should be the first on the reading list, a writer's coach, publisher?
It's Random House. This is Pantheon.
Pantheon Books.
That's the hardcover. $24.95
USA.
You can get it cheaper on Amazon.com.
Is that right?
And the paperback, the trade paperback, will come out on another Random House imprint next August, August of 2007. That's vintage.
Cool. Okay, a writer's coach. After that, the next three books that you would recommend to a narrative, for somebody who wants to be a narrative writer.
Fiction,
I really have to stop at three, huh? Well, you go on and on, as long as it takes
less. Well, if you haven't read John Franklin's classic, Writing for Story, I think you absolutely have to read that. I think Chapter 4 of Writing for Story is the best explanation of story theory for somebody from a print journalism background or a journalism background that you'll find out there. I think Bill Blundell's Art and Craft of Feature Writing is a wonderful book, particularly when it comes to idea generation and really pushing ideas and getting good ideas to start the writing process off on the right foot. Roy Peter Clark has a new book out, 50 Writing Tools, which should certainly be very useful to read. There are some good books on craft for fiction writers that translate to nonfiction writers, because the careful scene construction and use of thematic detail.
One by Saul Stein.
Yeah.
Remember the name of it.
Yeah, Saul's is pretty good. Yeah. And Janet Burroway's, I think it's called Writing Fiction or something like that, is very good. Let's see, there's another one by Macaulay and Lanning that's a very good book. There's more of a literature on technique aimed at fiction writers than there is at nonfiction writers. Stewart's Follow the Story is a good one for would-be narrative writers, although there isn't a really comprehensive, thorough book, I don't think, that's current, aimed at journalists, nonfiction storytellers out there. So that's what I'm working on
now.
That's
your next project.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
When will that be out?
Well, God, I write from 8 to 9 every morning before I go to the office, so it takes me a while.
Well, and one of the things you mentioned here, particularly in the beginning, is this notion of really kind of being using your time well, being organized in your approach, and having a process. And, I mean, your book is rigorously, from my point of view, well organized. It's very easy. And
my editor gets a lot of credit for that.
Right? Because that's the one thing that, you know, when I talk to journalists that I talk a little bit about, maybe because I have such a hard time with it, is that if you invent a kind of process for yourself and you see step by step I can get from here to there, you can get past that writer's block.
Yeah, well, yeah. It takes a lot of the anxiety out of it, because all I have to do now is step 4, and that's this little entirely manageable thing that I know I can do. And when that's done, I'll go on to step 5. So.
And so you know that I've only got an hour a day, but it'll be, that's an hour closer to my goal than I was
sooner or later. Well, you know, that's 300 hours a year. It adds up.
Right. Okay, well, I hope the profits add up on your book, Jack, and thanks for doing this podcast with me.
Nice talking to you.